I'm Ryan from the Dad.io podcast, a show dedicated to dorky dads everywhere. Part of the Gonna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other dadalicious geeky shows at GonnaGeekNetwork.com.
Welcome to Play Comics, where I'm pretty sure we're supposed to be talking about video games and stuff, but I just have too many cool creators wanting to talk about stuff, so we're just going to do that again for a while. Maybe for like 3 months straight. I don't know. Today, we have David Pepos back, this time to talk about a Kickstarter project. David, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to catch up and to talk about the return of the OZ to Kickstarter. So by the time this goes up, the Kickstarter should be live, and we're excited to have as many Yellow Brick Road Warriors join us as we can get.
So I feel like I should be able to tell just from the way you answered that. But for anybody who doesn't know, why don't you give us a little look on what the OZ actually is?
Sure. The OZ is like, what if the Hurt Locker took place in the Wizard of Oz? It's the story of Dorothy Gale's granddaughter, who's a disillusioned Iraq war veteran, who finds herself stranded in the war-torn land of Oz. And she discovers that because her grandmother killed two wicked witches and convinced the Wizard of Oz to leave, and then clicked her heels together three times and split, it caused a brutal power vacuum that's led to decades of bloody civil war. And so our new Dorothy is going to have to navigate her grandmother's former friends, the Tin Soldier, the Scarecrow, and the Courageous Lion, if she hopes to bring peace to the occupied zone, or as the locals call it, the OZ.
Oh, that works on so many levels. I love it.
Thank you. This is a very special project for me. It was one of three projects that I came up with after my breakout book, Spencer and Locke. I wrote Spencer and Locke 2, Going to the Chapel, and the OZ kind of on the heels of that. And I think this is one of the most beautiful books I've ever had the privilege of being involved in, working with artist Ruben Rojas, colorist Whitney Kogar from the Eisner Award-winning Giant Days, letterer DC Hopkins, and a murderer's row of variant cover talent. It's pound for pound, I think, just as creatively stacked as anything you might see from the direct market. And we've been hard at work for the last year since our last Kickstarter to get our second installment out to our readership. And I think our readers are going to realize that this book was worth the wait.
So besides the obvious public domain, don't have to worry about boogeyman's going after you for copyright reasons. Sure. What is it that drew you to the Wizard of Oz side of this?
Well, it was very much an idea that it was stumbling onto the core concept, really. When I had written my first book, Spencer and Locke, it was what if Calvin and Hobbes grew up in Sin City? And so, it was very much analog, or it was figuring out, kind of squinting and figuring out, okay, how can I evoke this imagery without outright stating this imagery? And I really liked that process, and I thought, could I take that to other genres? And so I wrote down, I thought sci-fi, I thought about fantasy, and fantasy really speaks to me. I think sci-fi, you have to be really smart, and you have to have a high concept that kind of fits within, it's at least extrapolates off of the rules of the world as we know it. Fantasy, you can kind of make your own rules, and they can kind of twist and warp around the themes of a story or around the voices of a particular character. And so fantasy really kind of spoke to me. And I wrote down a bunch of inspirations, just, things like Piers Anthony, Lloyd Alexander, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter. And when I wrote down The Wizard of Oz, it's funny, my cursor stuck. Google Docs just froze for a minute, and it froze on the word Oz. And I thought about it, and as I was waiting for my cursor to come back to life, I thought, you know, what if Oz was like an acronym for something? And I thought of the word occupied zone. And immediately it's just like the idea kind of hit me like a bolt of lightning. You know, it's a war story. It's not just a fantasy, but it's a war book. And yeah, you know, it's just the ball really kind of kept rolling for me from there. I'd written a term paper in college, actually, on L. Frank Baum's sort of use of continuity and world building, comparing it to what Stan and Jack did in Marvel in the 60s. And so, you know, all this sort of knowledge and mythology that I kind of had stored away in the back of my head, I realized, oh, you can use that. Yeah, you know, I got some really important encouragement, you know, kind of early on in the development process. Some editors that I really trust, you know, had said, like, this is a really cool project. And, like, you know, while, like, the timing didn't necessarily work for them with their publishers, they were like, you should not give up on this project. It really has legs. You should really pursue it. And yeah, you know, last year really kind of crystallized things, I think, for me and a lot of other creators. You know, Diamond had it shut down due to the pandemic, and all the publishers, you know, their acquisitions channels really narrowed as a result. And meanwhile, we had two issues of the OZ done, and I was sort of rounding the bases on finishing writing the whole series. And I realized, like, I could kind of solve one problem with another. I'd been meaning to introduce myself to the Kickstarter community as sort of a readership that doesn't always have a ton of overlap with the Wednesday Warriors that are hitting their comic shops every week. And meanwhile, giving sort of the best possible home for the OZ to give it a really running head start. And, you know, we had in total over 1,300 people back that project. And I couldn't be more grateful and more encouraged. And I'm excited to show those Yellow Brick Road Warriors what we have in store for part two.
I mean, having read your stuff before, I mean, just the fact that your name is on it is exciting for me. I'm sure you'll never get used to hearing that.
No, I will never get used to hearing that. So thank you for saying that.
But the whole concept of everything, like, I grew up, my dad was Air Force, so I'm used to dealing with the whole war side of everything. And sure. One year for Christmas, I decided everybody was getting books because the bookstore in the mall was doing, it was like, buy four, get one free, something like that. So sure. Everybody else got a book so I could get the collected Wizard of Oz.
That's great. That's wonderful. I mean, yeah, I think the thing that really drew me to using the Land of Oz is, you know, it's all about archetypes, you know. I think through cultural osmosis, everybody knows about the Judy Garland film. And so, you know, you can immediately envision, you know, Dorothy, Tin Man, Scarecrow, the Lion, maybe Toto, you know, is sort of an ancillary figure. And those archetypes, I think, are really strong. They're really powerful. And I think they're very flexible as a result. And that's been kind of the fun part of the OZ for me, is taking these characters and trying to do something new with them that still feels organic to the original. You know, sort of building upon this mythology in a way. Yeah, it's just, you know, it speaks to a lot of stuff that I really enjoy as a comics fan, and as somebody, you know, just kind of the entertainment that I like to consume. You know, this is, I think, a book that's also kind of geared towards the gaming crowd a bit. You know, some of my biggest inspirations for how this book was put together was games like Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy VII. Just the way that, like, you can put together a squad and they're all built off of very distinct archetypes. And that's what we're doing with Dorothy and her resistance. And it's been really cool to watch that unfold. And especially for our second issue, we're going to see what happens as Dorothy's unit starts to grow and see meeting new characters and seeing some of the unexpected allies she's going to turn to for help.
I didn't get to finish the first one, but how much have you gotten into characters that didn't show up until, like, the second book and further into the series?
Yeah, you know, so, you know, it's always been kind of a delicate high wire act because, you know, the Judy Garland film is, of course, sort of the cultural touchstone, you know, and so those kind of five characters are really kind of the core group. But, you know, we're also, you know, we're introducing characters like Jack Pumpkinhead, for example, who I'm a big fan of, you know, since watching Return to Oz, which is my favorite Oz media. You know, we're also throwing in, you know, Easter eggs. I mean, there's so much fun continuity that you can kind of throw in there, whether it's sort of the different threats you know, that are being faced against, the different monsters that Dorothy's going to have to stand down. Lots of little cameos here and there. I can't tell you, you know, our last Kickstarter, the number one question that I got, and I was so shocked to get this question, is, are there going to be Wheelers in this book? That's what everybody asked me, is there going to be Wheelers in this book? And you know, at the time, I hadn't planned on it. But, you know, that's the cool thing about doing Kickstarters, is that you've got time to kind of pivot and adjust a little bit in between installments. And so we've got some Wheelers in the mix. They do exist in this world and in this universe. But yeah, you know, it's very much, you know, a question of, you know, what characters can you fit in the mix that aren't going to confuse or alienate sort of the general readership, but can still provide some fun Easter eggs for like the diehard Oz fans. And we have some fun stuff planned with some of these characters. And it's just, you know, it's only going to get bigger and more expansive from here.
What's been the biggest difference for you working on this for Kickstarter versus working on something for a more traditional publisher?
Oh boy, there's a ton of differences there. I mean, I think the first big lesson that I learned is kind of, I had prepared for failure, you know, and I think that's just, you know, that's the comics mentality, you know, where we kind of operate from a perspective of scarcity. And, you know, that sort of informs a lot of things that we do. You know, we can be a little conservative with our ambitions because we don't know if we can afford it. And the thing that kind of really changed my way of thinking was my last Kickstarter. I had prepared for failure, but I had not prepared for success. And so I thought, you know, can we make $6,000 in 30 days? I did not think, what happens if we make that in 2 hours? And so it became really much like a game of catch up for the rest of the campaign, where I was like, okay, what can we keep adding to the campaign to add more value, to entice more readers, to keep the campaign energized and exciting in a way that is affordable and we can sort of hit our deadlines with it and not blow up our shipping and production fees as a result. And, you know, that's been kind of the fun part about this second Kickstarter, is that I've had a year to prepare. And so now we've got some ideas planned. You know, I mean, we're not trying to count our chickens before they hatch, but, you know, if we do cross 6,000.
This is the part where I go ahead and tell you that we recorded this a while ago and didn't quite realize that of the $6,000 David was trying to raise for this to get it made on Kickstarter, as of now, it's somewhere up over 32,000. So keep that in mind and just kind of laugh every time either one of us mentions the possibility of this getting funded. Or, I don't know, this might not get funded. Or, you know, anything like that that kind of implies that David doesn't have full faith in himself, because obviously, you know, about that part, he's wrong.
You know, we're not trying to count our chickens before they hatch. But, you know, if we do cross 6,000, maybe we'll do another digital comics extravaganza. Maybe we'll do another sticker or another enamel pin or another print. Maybe we'll do another theme song for our second issue. You know, there's a lot of fun stuff that we kind of have in our back pockets now. And I think it will make for, a more planned and more, you know, relaxed kind of environment. But there are other things, you know, I think also just other Kickstarter campaigns aren't your competition. I think that's a big misconception that a lot of people have, is we launched our campaign last year the same day as Scott Snyder launched his campaign for Nocterra, his new series over at Image. And, you know, in the direct market, yeah, that would be like, you know, the meteor hitting the dinosaurs. You know, you can't see it coming, but you're done. But for Kickstarter, it was like having a really incredible headwind at our backs. You know, Kickstarter's business model is they want as many projects to succeed as possible. And so they do, a really fantastic job at not just being accessible, you know, it's just a couple of buttons you have to click to get to order your books, but also just, you know, getting the word out about other people's projects. So every time that somebody would back Scott's campaign, they would get emails saying, oh, you should check out these other Kickstarter campaigns. And the OZ was like at the top of the list. And so, you know, Scott was bringing in all these new followers to Kickstarter, and they're like, what else is there? Well, let me check out the OZ. And you know, that happened midway through our campaign as well. Keanu Reeves and Boom Studios launched their Kickstarter for Berserker. And I think that kept the churn going. I think more and more people kept checking out Kickstarter and they kept saying, well, what else is there? You know, I think there is a market for these sort of bigger, you know, artisanal comics. You know, it's something that's feels weightier and more substantial than maybe a standard 20-page or 22-page chapter. And I think, you know, it was just, even if you don't have Scott or Keanu launching during your campaign, I think cross-promoting with your class of Kickstarter backers, it's sort of the perfect way to kind of build that community and to sort of, you know, build your own readership.
I mean, I've absolutely loved every single Kickstarter comic that I've gotten.
So yeah,
it's nice to know that it's not a competitive thing, really.
No, I think it's a misconception that a lot of people on the outside have. And I think sometimes, you know, new Kickstarter creators, I think they have that direct market mentality. And it's not the case for Kickstarter. Really, it can be very collaborative if you let it. And I think it's something that should be encouraged. I think, you know, the Kickstarter community, I think, is so vocal and passionate and dedicated, and they recognize that they're not just buying comics for the story, although they are, of course, but they're also doing it to really promote artists, you know, and they feel that sense of ownership and that sense of that they're helping bring a project to life. And I think that's something that's really inspiring, and it's something that's going to keep me using Kickstarter as a platform, you know, for the foreseeable future.
So when you talk to publishers about anything, do they have any concerns with you having stuff out on Kickstarter at all?
No, I mean, you know, I think every publisher kind of has its own relationship with Kickstarter. But I think especially over the last year with the Diamond shutdown and seeing creators like Scott Snyder and Kyle Higgins and Keanu Reeves, of course, you know, seeing them do Kickstarter, I think people are realizing, like, okay, like, it's not, you're not cannibalizing your readership. You know, there is very, I think, minimal overlap between the direct market and the Kickstarter readers. It's just, I think that's the thing that got me to take the plunge in the first place, was people saying, you really should try a Kickstarter, because it's a whole subsection of readers that you've done no outreach to in the direct market. You know, it's like most of these Kickstarter backers, I would say, are never going to walk into a comic shop, no matter what you do. Just like there are some people that buy their books only on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or only buy them at a con, or only read at Webtoons. There's a diaspora amongst the readership. And I think as a creator, it's incumbent upon us individually to try to reunite that readership and kind of invite them to the same table. And so, you know, I mean, look, there are certain publishers that, you know, for their own IP reasons, aren't usually keen on doing a Kickstarter, you know, but there are other publishers. I mean, Image has taken, you know, books that have been Kickstartered. Black Mask has done the same thing. Scout Comics has done the same thing. You know, I'm pretty sure Dark Horse has. They certainly have done books up from Comixology. So I think people are realizing, like, it is a different sort of readership. And I think with the Substack news that's been sort of, everybody's been talking about this last week, I think that trend's only going to continue. You know, I think publishers, especially during the Diamond shutdown, are realizing, like, oh, you can't afford to leave any platforms on the table. And, you know, I think Kickstarter and the direct market, there is a way to do both in a way that I think is beneficial to both. And I think that is really beneficial to creators and fans.
I also love how Ruby decided to get quiet as we started recording.
I put her in the other room when I was getting my headphones. So she gets jealous when I do podcasts, so it was for the best.
Of all the things that she could have been on, though, this might have been a good one.
You know, for those who don't follow my Twitter feed, we're talking about my new puppy Ruby. She's a Cairn Terrier, same breed as Toto, and has a beautiful red coat. So of course we named her after the Ruby slippers. I got her 3 days after all the Kickstarter books from my last campaign showed up. So I spent all of my time doing fulfillment with a brand new puppy. Almost a year later, you know, it's, You know, she's gotten bigger and a little bit better behaved, but thankfully I've moved, so I have a brand new room to do all my fulfillment in. So yeah, if you saw any tooth marks in your taping last time, I promise that won't happen again.
Or maybe it will. Who knows?
Or maybe it will. Collector's item. It was just the tape. I should say Ruby doesn't bite any books because we don't let her have them. But yeah, rolls of masking tape. Those were her first chew toys coming home. So yeah, she's a Kickstarter puppy, and so she learned about the what goes into fulfillment from a very early age. So yeah, she would have been a great assistant if she had opposable thumbs, but. She'll be moral support while I do all the packing for these books.
That's important too, though. You got to make sure you have that around.
You know, I think that is, I will say, you know, going back to an earlier question you had of sort of what's the difference between Kickstarter and a direct market publisher. I think the printing and fulfillment is something that a lot of people don't understand. And I think that is that's the biggest learning curve, I think. But I think if you can figure it out, it's very empowering. You know, I from my earlier books, I knew how to put a book together, you know, just the writing and the editorial side. And I had learned how to do the publicity side just from my day job, but also, you know, having worked as a newspaper reporter and worked in comics journalism. But I never knew how to work with a printer. I never knew how to do my own distribution and shipping and fulfillment. Now I do. And that's great because, I don't have to wait for permission anymore to tell my stories. If there's something that really speaks to me, I'll chat with publishers to see if it's the best home for it. But sometimes, I don't want to wait. And, being able to go on Kickstarter and being able to sort of have a feasible, viable financial return on these books, sometimes, in orders of magnitude higher than what you might get from the direct market, that is really encouraging. And I think it winds up being another tool in the toolkit. You know, I want to make it very clear that, like, I think the binary of direct market versus Kickstarter is a little bit of a false binary. The metaphor about the diaspora that I was talking about earlier, you need to use all of these platforms and sometimes in conjunction with one another. And I think, as creators learn to do that, and if they're able to sort of put in the time and the effort to do all the fulfillment, which not everybody can do, that's how you start. There's a lot of potential, for building your readership and making a living at this. And I think Kickstarter is, I think, a very valuable component in all of that.
Yeah, I've seen plenty of smaller publishers using Kickstarters themselves. Like, if I saw Marvel doing a Kickstarter, that'd be like, what the hell are you guys doing?
Yeah, well, I'll be honest. I wouldn't be surprised if every publisher started using it within the next 5 to 10 years. I think just because people are starting to realize, it's a different readership, and if you can offer something, I think the way that Boom did their Berserker Kickstarter, I think is going to be a way that a lot of people, that's a model that I think a lot of people are going to start looking at. I mean, granted, you're not going to make $1 million in every Kickstarter just because, that's Keanu. But I think what they did was they did a Kickstarter for all the hardcovers, and the hardcovers would come out after the direct market singles. So there are people who would buy things on Kickstarter who aren't going to go to a comic shop, so it's not going to matter to them if they miss the singles. And then meanwhile, the shops are still happy because you've got a book like Keanu Reeves that's coming out through them in singles. And I assume, presumably, the trades as well, at least the soft covers as they're coming out. And, I think it's a win-win. I think I completely understand sort of the trepidation of, like, you don't want to crowd out independent creators. And so that's why I think any of that sort of thing is going to be kind of a slow trickle. I don't expect to see like a Batman comic coming out on Kickstarter anytime soon. But I think, more people on the platform is always a good thing. And I think it is going to self-select a little bit because, like I was saying, there are creators who, they're not going to earn enough to make a fulfillment service worth their while. And there are a whole lot of pros and cons to using a fulfillment service in terms of, how much does it cost and how safe are the books going to be in shipping. But I think a lot of people realize, if I'm writing like 5 big 2 books a month or something like that. I don't have time to spend 3 weeks doing fulfillment and going to the post office, you know? And so I think there will be a some degree of equilibrium that's going to happen with that. But yeah, I mean, I think it's not dissimilar to the argument that people had 10 years ago, where they were like, oh, you know, is Comixology going to cannibalize the print sales, you know, in the direct market? And I think the answer has been no. I think there's been very little, if any, cannibalization. Has just been growth. So I think, you know, it's an ongoing calculus. And I think publishers and creators alike kind of have to figure out, how do we build the readership? How do we build the platform and do it in a way that is sustainable? And, you know, only time will really tell on that one.
So if I looked at things correctly, this is your second Kickstarter campaign, right?
Yep. Yep. You know, I call myself a Kickstarter lurker. You know, I've backed, I think, 450 campaigns over the years, maybe more. You know, just because I want to see a thriving indie scene. And Kickstarter, you know, at least for now, is a great platform for people who might not fit within the constraints of the direct market, you know, and sort of have a voice that is perhaps underrepresented, you know, in our comics ecosystem. Yeah, this is my second Kickstarter, and I feel like we've learned a lot since the last one. You know, now it's less about having to build the framework around me. And now, you know, the framework's been built. You know, I know how to ship stuff. I know how, you know, I know what a Gemini mailer is now. I know how to send stuff through that. I know how to figure, you know, I know pirate shipping. I know what international shipping costs are like. And I apologize to anyone listening in the UK in advance, because your shipping costs are very expensive. You know, it's you learn with every campaign. I've been really fortunate that I've had a lot of Kickstarter veterans who have been, you know, very gracious with their time and advice to help me out. People like Charlie Stickney, the creator of White Ash, which I consider to be kind of the quintessential comics Kickstarter success story. Ryland Grant, creator of The Jump and The Peacekeepers, who he did a terrific job on his campaigns there. You know, Clay Adams from Nightmare Theater Horror Anthology. David Avalone, you know, there's so many people who have been really generous with their time and their advice. You know, who knows what the next Kickstarter is going to look like? You know, as we're talking, it's just before the Kickstarter launches. You know, we have a lot of people who seem interested, you know, 530 people just for the pre-launch page. But, you know, I'm hoping that we have a lot of success. You know, we delivered, I think, a quality product, and we did it on time. Last time, and I think that's kind of a rarity. You know, life happens and there are a lot of delays, but we hit our deadline and with a product that I think we're all very proud of. And so I think, you know, the sky's the limit from here. I think you know, I'm hoping to see that we might even achieve even more growth.
You're just making me feel really lucky with mine, because I've had only two things that were delivered late. I mean, outside of like the next month, because that's just whatever.
Sure.
But like, and one of them, the person just kind of flaked out and they suck. And the other one involved somebody having back surgery. So what are you going to do? He kept us all informed.
Exactly. I mean, and I think that's a big thing that is another big thing that I think sometimes creators overlook. It's the interactivity of Kickstarter, which I really like. That really keeps me energized. It's kind of like, you know, especially, you know, with the pandemic going on and conventions being kind of few and far between and it being kind of a toss-up, certain conventions even happening this year because of the Delta variant. It's very much like a con experience. You know, you get to have that interactivity with your readership and the back and forth. And, you know, I always had a blast. Every evening, I would send thank you notes. I would send a thank you note to every single backer, just because, like, it's that personal touch that keeps people invested. Keeps people interested, makes them feel like they're a part of something bigger. And yeah, you know, I think it's something that, especially, you know, seeing all the discourse about Substack, you know, I think that kind of removes a lot of the interactivity. While I understand, you know, that there's money to be made there, I think, unlike Twitter, you know, you don't get to talk to your readership. You know, you don't get to sort of acknowledge when they're saying something nice about you. You don't get to sort of share that It is a more of a one-sided dynamic. And Kickstarter, I really love because, yeah, you get to be a little bit of a carnival barker saying, look what we got right here. But then every time somebody talks about it, you get to be like, oh, hey, man, thanks so much for supporting. Thanks so much for backing. And I think readers are not, you can't do that in the direct market. You know, you can't do that for a book that sells 100,000 copies. But for a Kickstarter where you've got, you know, 1,200, 1,300 backers, that becomes a lot more manageable. It sort of really kind of, it's a very heartening process, and it's one that's, really encourages me to sort of bring my A game.
What kind of backer rewards are you expecting to have up for this one?
Yeah, we've got a ton of really fun stuff planned. So the big thing I want to stress is that if you missed our first Kickstarter campaign, we have catch-up tiers, both digital and print. We even have early bird discounts for the first 48 hours. We want to meet readers where they're at. So if you missed the first Kickstarter campaign, there is a place for you in our second one to catch up. So we want to have you on board. If you've never read any of my work, we've got bundles with all of my trade paperbacks, including Spencer and Locke, Spencer and Locke 2, Going to the Chapel, and my new series, Scout's Honor, over at Aftershock. We'll have the trade paperback available on that. Assuming our sales are, even remotely solid, we'll also have a backer kit store on the back end of the campaign to be able to buy all these items a la carte. We'll have bundles for all four of our covers for issue 2. And if you're a diehard collector and missed the first campaign, we'll also have bundles for all 9 covers that we've released so far for our first 2 issues. And then we've got some really cool, kind of very exclusive things as well. We have a couple of original commissions from series artist Ruben Rojas. You'll be able to see a couple examples on our campaign page. He puts in a lot of work into these black and white images, and they look, it's a steal. We have an opportunity to get drawn into the book. We've got a couple cameo slots in there. We have a couple very limited edition handmade Spencer and Locke plushies from my personal collection. I had some made for our creative team. We have a couple left. And then my favorite, a lot of people have been asking for a long time since my book Scout's Honor came out. It was a book about a post-apocalyptic Boy Scout cult. And so as a promotional item, we made 14 Ranger Scout merit badges. The thing is that they were not all available to retailers. Some of them were at the Comics Pro Summit. Some of them, I believe, are scheduled to be at conventions. I believe one might even be just exclusive to Aftershock and Aftershock staff. We're giving away 3 complete sets of all 14 merit badges. And you won't be able to get that anywhere besides Kickstarter, because I think I'm one of the few people that has complete sets of any of them. That's going to be a fun item to have as well. A Skype session with me. You can talk about writing for comics. I've written for a number of publishers, or how do you do comics publicity? I was the reviews editor at Newsarama for a decade. How do you run a Kickstarter? How do you navigate Hollywood? Spencer Locke was an option for film very early on in its run. You set the agenda, really. There's all sorts of fun items you can get really at any sort of level of your budget. If you just want kind of the bare bones, you can throw down $10. You can get a 44-page PDF of the OZ number 2, plus the first issue PDFs of Spencer and Locke number 1 and Going to the Chapel number 1. Those are going to be in every single tier, just because we want to make sure all of our readers feel valued. You'll get my script for issue 2. You'll get Ruben Rojas's raw inks, as well as Whitney Kogar's untouched colors. And that's on top of, any stretch goals we hit. If I were a betting man, we'll probably get to our digital comics extravaganza like we did last time. That'll probably be another 10 to 12 first issue PDFs from some very cool up and coming indie talent. So already you're throwing down $10 and you're getting 88 pages of story just from me, plus, as a rough napkin estimate, another 220 pages of story from 10 other creators. So, 300 pages of story for $10, that's a steal, no matter where how you slice it. And, the more you throw in, the more cool stuff you get. So we're very excited to show our readers what we've been cooking up for this last year.
That just makes me jealous of anybody who gets any of the merit badges, because my shop was getting my copies of Scout's Honor and maybe one or two other people. So they didn't get any at all.
They didn't get any. Well, yeah, this will be the opportunity to get it. You know, we have three sets available. So, you know, we're hoping people are going to snap those up pretty quick. But yeah, it's wild. That's really the only place you can get them, at least for now. You know, if Aftershock changes their plans, so, you know, hopefully they'll let me know before they tell everybody else. Yeah, as far as at this juncture, I think I'm the only one who has complete sets. So, yeah, this Kickstarter will be the only place you can get them.
So what did you do? Like, shove all the other people working on Scout's Honor with you down onto the floor so you could grab all the sets and they could have done it?
Well, you know, I shouldn't say. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if some of the Aftershock crew might have complete sets. And Luca Castellanguida might, you know, he doesn't speak English, so we don't, like, have, like, that relationship for, like, the small talk of, like, hey, did you get all the badges? And same thing with Matt Miller. You know, he's working on a million different books, you know, at Marvel and at Aftershock. And same with Carlos Manguel. I think they're all kind of juggling projects at this point. So they may have complete sets. I shouldn't say it's just me, but I'm definitely the only one that's putting them out for the rest of the world.
Well, that's very nice of you. See, that's why people should give you their money.
I'm the real hero here. No, I you know, it's just, I had such a blast kind of putting those Ranger's Cap merit badges together. And I think a lot of stores either didn't hit the minimum to get them, or they didn't hear about the order minimums, or, you know, there was just a lot that kind of happened with that. And I wish we had a little more runway to promote them. I didn't even know the order numbers by the time that the cutoff happened. But yeah, you know, I think it's made a lot of people very excited for those merit badges. And yeah, I put a lot of work into them. You know, I wrote backstories for every single one. It's all in the first issue. So yeah, all 14 of those merit badges, those are real. I have them in my closet right now. Yeah, you might be a lucky combination Yellow Brick Road Warrior and Ranger Scout recruit and have these Ranger Scout badges maybe on your own lapel.
Well, I know for my shop, I just live in a very mainstream market. So
sure, I get it.
Nothing
I get
you can
it.
Do about that.
Well, it's tough to get traction for the indies, you know, especially, you know, when you're a creator like me, who, you know, I don't have any sort of big licensed properties under my belt yet. And, you know, yeah. So I think things like the Ranger Scout merit badges, you know, hopefully it'll be like a cool little artifact, you know, as my career goes on.
So I realize you're not doing the art, but how do you work around having somebody drawn into the book as one of the rewards?
Sure. Well, you know, I'm sort of, especially for the OZ, I'm definitely sort of the editor on that book as well as the writer. And so, yeah, what we do is, you know, as Ruben Rojas's pages come in, I'm usually sort of keeping an eye out, like, is there any crowds in there, you know, that we could fit somebody into, you know, what's sort of going on in the background that, you know, we might be able to drop somebody into. And then, yeah, when the campaign goes on, you know, we just, after the campaign wraps and we've charged them for the backing, I just say, okay, I need a photo, whether it's you or whether it's a friend. And then I send that to Ruben, and Ruben works to kind of fit them in. So usually, you know, it's just taking the head off of a background character and putting the cameo background there. But every so often, you know, we do a little bit more substantial stuff. I mean, my dad made a cameo in the last issue as the Munchkin guard that Dorothy punches in the face. My aunt was the one that backed that part, and I don't think Ruben knew at the time that he was drawing my dad. And I was like, oh, you put my dad in this particular moment. But yeah, you know, it's really just, it's finding space where we can that feels organic, that's not going to distract to the rest of the plot. But I find that those are really popular. You know, those are kind of a fun keepsake. You know, how often do you get to say, oh, hey, I got drawn into a comic book? Ruben makes it look good, and Whitney really makes it look seamless. And, you know, it adds a couple extra steps to the mix, of course. But I think, you know, whatever kind of promotes that sense of ownership amongst our readership, I think it's worth taking a little bit of extra time.
I wish I had the money for those.
You know, they are rare, you know, and yeah, you know, those are sort of more of our premier price points, because yeah, it is a lot of work to put it in there, and we want to make sure that, like, if we're taking time out of Ruben's busy schedule, that the compensation is worth it. But yeah, it's just those are usually the rewards, that and the commissions. Those usually are gone within the first week, maybe sooner. So yeah, those are very popular tiers. So we'll continue to do those as long as people are interested.
Well, from what I've seen from other campaigns and stuff, people are never not going to be interested in those.
Yeah, no, it's fun. I mean, if I wasn't doing this as a pro, I'd probably consider it at some point, you know, just because, yeah, like, what a cool keepsake. Being able to see yourself in the background of a book. I've only been fortunate enough to have it happen to me once in going to the chapel. Yeah, it's something that I'd love to have happen, happen again further down the line.
What advice would you have somebody specifically looking to make a comic for Kickstarter?
I think there's a couple of things that I can in part, you know, one is making sure that, like, this is going to be something different than you would have in the direct market. You know, making sure that if you're going to have a higher price point, make sure that it's more content, or make sure there's some way you can get more bang for your buck, but do it in a way that you can ship it, or you can distribute it digitally. That is, I think, the kiss of death that a lot of people don't realize, is that, like, if somebody's like, oh, well, I'm going to do a t-shirt for a stretch goal, or I'm going to do a statue for a stretch goal. Well, you've just blown up your shipping budget. You know, it has to be something that can, like, fit flat, you know, especially like in a Gemini mailer. And if you can't do that, or something that can fit in like a priority mailbox, if you can't do that, like, you will have major problems. And on top of that, it's like, then you have to start figuring out manufacturing, and when are you going to get the stuff in? That's a can of worms you don't want to deal with. Stickers, enamel pins, prints, you know, extra pages in the book, you know, anything digital, you know, like our digital comics extravaganza, or the theme song that we did last time. Those are kind of good ways to add more value without adding more weight. You know, I think not treating it as a competition, you know, cross promoting with other campaigns that are going on at the same time, I think is really helpful in terms of building each other's audiences. You know, I think, and just giving yourself a lot of runway, you know, that is something that we had learned last time, was we did a campaign from August to September with a December turnaround. And while we made that, it was very tight, you know, and it was probably more stress than I think any of us needed. So we've given ourselves a little bit of a longer runway this second Kickstarter. And I think if you're in danger of not hitting that runway, just communicating with your readers every step of the way, I think, you know, people understand, like you were saying, like, oh, the guy had back surgery, you know, of course it's going to take an extra month, like, no big deal. But I think oftentimes campaigns, you know, they get embarrassed that, you know, things aren't moving as fast as they should, and they don't say anything. And then that's when readers get really ticked off, and they say, well, you already have my money, where's my book? And, you know, I think there are ways that you can kind of mitigate that, especially if it winds up being like an issue with printing or an issue with shipping. You know, the first thing we did when we got the books in was, you know, I said, I'm pretty sure we'll have this out on time, but in the event we don't, I want to send everybody the PDFs now so they know the books exist. Like, the story is done, like, you're going to get that experience. And so you will have that hard copy in your hands very soon. But just to give some people something to, some sort of hope, you know? Yeah, I feel like those are kind of the big things, but just knowing that, like, it is different than the direct market. There is a certain degree of more work that goes into it, because you're a one-man band. You don't have a publisher's infrastructure. You don't have Diamond's infrastructure. But that means you're taking a much larger piece of the pie home with you. So I think, you know, there are pros and cons to it, but I think every creator who wants to make a living at this, and every creator who wants to build their readership, I think they should strongly consider using Kickstarter as a tool, because that's going to be the thing that really helps them sort of, you know, financially and build their audience down the road.
Oh yeah, being a one-man band, I don't know anything about that over here at all.
Yeah, exactly.
A couple kind of more random questions to finish things off. Who was your favorite Muppet? Sure.
Probably Gonzo. Even as a kid, I was just like, oh, you know. Well, actually, you know what? No, it was Grover. I forgot. Because I think Super Grover, like, kind of hit me at, like, the right age. And so, you know, and between that, and there's a monster at the end of the book. I think, you know, those he was, like, my favorite childhood Muppet. But I think as an adult, I still admire Grover for everything he does. But I relate more to Gonzo. You know, he marches to the beat of his own drum. You know, he's unapologetically himself. And, yeah, he's a weird dude, but you remember him. And he's not weird in, like, a creepy way. And so, you know, I think, yeah, I like Gonzo.
Gonzo's a really good one. We've had a couple people say him.
Yeah.
And it hasn't surprised me on any of them. Might not have been who I'd picked for him, but it's not a big surprise.
That's funny. Yeah. No, I like Gonzo a lot.
And finally, what is the weirdest thing that happened in your hometown?
The weirdest thing that happened in my hometown. Trying to think of, like, the history of St. Louis and, like, what are some weird things that happened there. I mean, boy, I'm sure there are weirder things that have happened in St. Louis, but, like, of course, the weird historical St. Louis thing I just think of is, like, Ellie Kemper and her weird, pageant queen, like, that was sort of, like, white supremacist group. It was very weird. I remember that kind of hitting the news a few months back, and I was just like, oh, that's so weird. I guess the other thing, it's not weird to me, but it's probably weird to everybody else. It's our pizza. You know, St. Louis style pizza is, like, a very acquired taste. It's cracker thin crust. It's cut into squares. It's with something called Provel cheese, which technically the FDA won't let you call it cheese because it doesn't have quite the right moisture content to it. It's a little more like a Velveeta kind of thing. If you're not from St. Louis, you just won't like it. But if you've grown up there or you have family there, it's, like, genetic, then you like it. It's John Hamm's favorite pizza. You know, he was talking about it on Fallon, I think, a few years back. Or maybe it was Jimmy Kimmel. Yeah, that's probably the weirdest thing about St. Louis that nobody really gets unless you've lived there.
I can get behind cutting it into squares. I have no issue there.
You're like, everything else sounds like it.
I'll eat the thin crust.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like other normal thin crust pizza as much, but, you know, it's fine.
Yeah.
The not cheese, that's, I mean, I'll try it. We'll see what happens.
It's good. It's very good. You know, the best way I can approximate it is two parts cheddar, one part Swiss, one part provolone, and spray it with a little bit of liquid smoke. That's, like, the closest I can get to making it out here in LA. It's very much its own unique thing, and it breaks my heart that there's only one place in Los Angeles that has Provel cheese at all. It's the Top Round sandwich company. They have a Provel grilled cheese, of all things. It's something I miss. And so every time I'm home, it's, like, the first thing I get when I get off the plane.
Well, David, it has been great talking to you again. If people want to hear more from you, where else can they find you around the internet?
Sure. Well, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at PeposD or David Pepos Comics on Facebook. You can subscribe to my newsletter, Pep Talks, at bit.ly/pepnews, or visit my website at davidpepos.com. And finally, you know, if you're interested in the OZ, just find us on Kickstarter. It's bit.ly/theozcomic or the OZ Comic 2. Both links will take you to the same place. And every backer matters. Every dollar counts. I think, a lot of people don't know is, like, the number of backers you get, especially in the first 48 hours, that impacts how much Kickstarter will promote your work elsewhere. It's just, you know, in their algorithm. So every backer matters. And honestly, I don't care about the money, because the secret is all the money's going to go towards rent or paying for other to make other projects. For me, it's more about how many readers can we get out of this? How many people can we introduce to this book that we've really put our hearts and souls into? You know, I'm the weak member of the team. You know, I mean, seeing Ruben and Whitney and Dave Hopkins all jam out together is really, it's worth the price of admission. To be honest, readers are getting a bargain for it. And so, you know, join our Emerald Army, you know, back the OZ and be prepared for some really exciting stuff.
Well, you're definitely going to be getting some of my money. I can guarantee you that.
Thank you. Thank you. It means the world. You know, I think there'll be some really fun stuff headed your way.
As always, if you want to hear more from me, head on over to playcomics.com where you can find links to all the social media things, which mostly these days involves Twitter. So maybe just go to twitter.com/playcomicscast. I don't know. There's links to that all over the website. You should go check out links because it's easier than spelling. Still, I know I just said that. If you want to help support the show, you can head on also to playcomics.com where you can head on over to the support page and see different ways that you can give me money, or you can just shove this podcast into somebody else's ear holes. Making other people hear it is always a good choice. Or you can just download it on like 12 different people's phones and just delete it or something. You know, a download is a download, no matter how small. Don't forget that Play Comics is part of the Gunna Geek Network, home to other wonderful geeky shows. At this point, I don't even know if I'm going to try to think of a different word to describe them. Wonderful just seems to work. I might just have to forget that other adjectives ever actually existed. If you like the music that I'm really talking on top of right now, head on over to soundcloud.com/best-day to check out Best Day's music. Most of all, just grab a game, grab a stack of comics, go support a Kickstarter or two or 20. I don't know. I don't control your budget. I'm not your parent. Do what you want. But find yourself a new favorite character. I recently switched what I was using to record with, just on the super local end. So I had to reset up all of my magic buttons, and some of them I can't do exactly like I had before. It's kind of annoying. All right.